At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The U.S. Government's Guide to Stress. It's not the latest self-help title bound for the bestseller list. Before federal regulators release results of their so-called stress tests on the big banks, they're reportedly preparing an official guide to the numbers to avoid any misperceptions that could be disastrous. That's why the White House suggested today, when it comes to those stress tests, we should all relax. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear conversations with poets about the economy, music, cooking, and more at americanpublicmedia.org/poetry.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Glad you've managed to take a breather from doing the numbers on your 1040 and join us on this tax day, the 15th of April. The whole idea of those financial industry stress tests was providing some clarity about the bank's financial health. Put them on a treadmill and see how they'd perform in the event of further trouble. It was never really clear, though, what the Treasury would do with the results. There was some concern that releasing the information could be bad news for the sickest banks. Investors and clients might stop doing business with them, worried they might collapse. Another issue was raised today on MSNBC by the congressional bailout watchdog Elizabeth Warren. What if the stress test isn't thorough enough to be convincing?
You've got to believe the numbers so that everyone can say, hey, these are the banks that are solvent, these are the banks that are not solvent.
Plenty of people on Wall Street and on Capitol Hill have been demanding that kind of transparency, and it looks as though the government is willing to take a bit of a risk. Today, it said it'll release certain details about the tests. Ashley Milne-Tite reports from New York.
Transparency has been a big issue for this plan since it was first announced. Doug Elliott is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He says regulators may argue that keeping quiet about the results may be the best way to keep the banks safe, but he says no one even knows exactly what the tests entail.
It would be very helpful to explain more of the details of how the tests were actually performed. We don't necessarily know, for example, how they went about valuing the so-called toxic assets.
Some banks are certain to need more capital, says Stacey Schreft. She directs investment strategy at the mutual fund store. She says if the government had tried to keep a lid on the state of the bank's health, it could have spooked investors. She says some disclosure was inevitable.
Once you tell people you're doing the tests, it's kind of hard to not tell them what the results are, because you're immediately going to think the results must be bad if they don't want to tell us.
Saying nothing about the plan could prompt some wild speculation about banks' performances. Gerard Cassidy is a banking analyst at RBC Capital Markets. He says the sooner the government releases some information, the better.
Because if they don't release some good details on the results, we believe they'll leak out. There will be some rumors that will probably circulate, and that will certainly negatively impact the banks.
Then there's always the possibility one of the banks could hint that it's just fine, thank you. Cassidy says either way, the government needs to set the rules or the banks could get in there first. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Hawaii may have some things other states don't, like gorgeous beaches and spectacular golf courses, but the Aloha State is just like nearly every other state when it comes to revenue trouble. It's looking at a big shortfall this year. The state's tourism business is already suffering, so to make up for it, it's proposing a tax that will increase hotel bills. Jennifer Collins reports.
This is a great time to go to Maui. There are cheap flights, cheap rooms, it's hot and sunny, the beaches are open, but that's not helping Tana Swanson. She owns Maui Guest House, and her business is off around 30% this year.
This month, I'll have several nights where nobody is staying here. I can't even fill one guest room. That's a shock to me. That's how scared we are right now.
And the fear is growing. Hawaii has a nearly $2 billion budget shortfall. And to make up for it, it may hit up one of its biggest industries, tourism. Some state lawmakers want to boost one of the taxes on hotel rooms from around 7% to around 12%. Bill Connors is with the National Business Travel Association.
Cities and municipalities and jurisdictions that decide to take their economic frustration out on their visitors, it's not a wise policy move and will hurt them in the end.
He says Honolulu has been one of the most tourist-friendly destinations when it comes to taxes. But the proposed increase could keep corporate visitors away.
So this is just another reason for people to stay away from Hawaii.
And that's the last thing the state needs. Tourists spend around $13 billion a year in the islands, and Hawaii has just come off one of its worst years in nearly two decades. If this measure passes, it could go into effect this summer. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
The skies just got more unfriendly for anybody who can't fit into their assigned seat on United Airlines. United is now cracking down on what it considers oversized human cargo, which means it's insisting on, yes, yet another fee. Plus-size passengers will have to pay for a second ticket or an upgrade. And even if there happens to be an empty seat, there's still no wiggle room. Don't expect United to waive the extra charge. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains.
Chalk this up to the current state of the airline industry. With demand in a tailspin, hundreds of aircraft have been taken out of circulation, which means the planes in the air are full.
What that means is on many, many flights, there simply are no empty seats into which one might allow a large customer to overflow.
That delicate statement comes from airline industry consultant Robert Mann. He says United is following Southwest by charging larger passengers, but it's taking an even harder line. And Mann says others may soon follow.
Certainly you aren't going to make friends with an individual that's confronted with that sort of policy. The question will be is if that individual is confronted with that sort of policy industry-wide, do they just choose to not fly or do they choose to pay up?
In Canada, airlines treat obesity as a medical issue and provide an extra seat free of charge. There's no such legal requirement here. Still, most U.S. airlines try to work with passengers without swiping the credit card. But, says Seth Kaplan of Airline Weekly,
United has obviously determined that this is going to please more people than it's going to anger.
In New York's Grand Central Station, travelers had mixed opinions. Adrian Miller thinks on a full flight, United's policy makes sense.
It makes it uncomfortable for me to be sitting in a seat where, you know, I'm having to shrink down my own body size and my own comfort level just to let this space be taken.
Sally Lee disagrees.
We can't all be the same size zero like the poshies of this world, you know, and I think it's very unfair to expect people to pay for two seats.
In a nod to its larger passengers, United says they do have the option to refund their ticket with no penalty. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Incidentally, this issue has been a hot topic all day over on our blog, The Scratch Pad, at marketplace.org. Wall Street rallied today on reports from the Fed suggesting the economy might, just might, be bottoming out. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Take a look at line 71 on your 1040, or on the easy 1040, it's line 11. That's where you find out your tax payout for the past year. Too bad there's no line that tells you where it's all going, especially those trillions in bailouts. So many different programs have been cooked up. Keeping track of that money is next to impossible. You may have heard, for example, that the Fed has been buying up mortgage-backed securities, and that's driven mortgage rates to historic lows. But Marketplace's Steve Henn has learned the U.S. Treasury's been doing this, too, in a big way for the past 8 months, and nobody seems to have noticed.
Since October, the U.S. Treasury has spent $124 billion buying mortgage-backed securities guaranteed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Tom LaMalfa is a mortgage industry economist. It's his job to know about stuff like this. But until we called and asked him about the program, LaMalfa had no idea it existed.
We've all been tracking on a weekly basis Fed purchases, but the initial $124 billion that came out of the Treasury's pocket just fell into the black hole.
Since the beginning of the year, the Federal Reserve's been buying mortgage-backed securities, too. Together, the Fed and Treasury have spent nearly $400 billion propping up this market. That's driven down interest rates, helping homeowners. However, David Rees, a law professor at Brooklyn College, says if lots of homeowners default, the government could lose money. But
they're already on the hook for all of the liabilities of Fannie and Freddie to begin with. I can't see what the additional downside is.
In fact, the Treasury expects to earn billions of dollars a year off this investment. Still, Rees is amazed a program this size largely escaped public notice. In 8 months, members of Congress haven't held a single hearing about it or asked a single question. And remember, this costs roughly what it costs to fund the war in Iraq for a year.
You know, if you had said this to me 9 months ago, I would have said it's impossible.
Paul Kyle, a journalist at the nonprofit group ProPublica, discovered it, digging through the Treasury Department's monthly balance sheet.
It's a little line item in this report that Treasury issues every month. Just buried there is we spent $124 billion buying all these securities from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Treasury officials told Marketplace it's not like they were hiding this. Officials announced this program when it began in September, but perhaps it's a sign of the times. When it comes to the bailout, it's possible for the public to lose track of more than $100 billion. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
By the way, you can search ProPublica's bailout database and try following your tax dollars at work through our website. It's marketplace.org. Well, let's hope Amy Scott has done her taxes because she's back on the road this week. Last fall, Amy and Marketplace Money host Tess Vigeland hit the interstate. They set out from opposite coasts to ask Americans whether the financial crisis had set this country on the road to ruin. 6 months later, they're revisiting some of the places they stopped along the way. Today, we find Amy in Youngstown, Ohio.
When I passed through here last October, people were excited about the Chevy Cruze. General Motors planned to start building the fuel-efficient car in nearby Lordstown next year. The plant had just added a third shift. Now, GM is on the brink of bankruptcy. Jim Graham is president of the United Auto Workers Local 1112.
We went from three shifts. In 3 months, we went down to one shift.
Graham says 2,000 people lost their jobs. Still, he says the Cruze is on track for next year, even as GM closes plants around the country.
There's no doubt in my mind, because gas prices are not going to stay down. They're going to go up. It's at least a light at the end of the tunnel for here in Lordstown.
Last October, the area's unemployment rate was 7.5%. Now it's nearing 14%. It's the highest in Ohio. John Russo co-directs the Center for Working Class Studies at Youngstown State University. As the rest of the country struggles with a relatively new recession, he says Youngstown never recovered from the collapse of the steel industry in the 1970s.
Youngstown's been in a type of regional depression. You don't lose 50,000 jobs. You don't lose, $1.3 billion in lost annual manufacturing wages and recover. It takes a long period of time, and maybe it will never be the same city it once was.
Leaders are trying to figure out what kind of city it will be. One of them is Phil Kidd. He's a community organizer and founder of a group called Defend Youngstown. Kidd is pushing a plan to tear down vacant buildings throughout Youngstown. He says the city needs to downsize and spend federal stimulus money on development. He says the thing about a place so downtrodden is that it's ripe for innovation. A business incubator downtown has helped develop one of the country's fastest-growing software companies.
that's who's being attracted to Youngstown, people that want to search for that answer and people that want to engage in that process of figuring this out. It's like an urban laboratory of sorts.
The laboratory has drawn people like Tyler and Jackie Clark to town.
Okay, I'm going to the London Bridge.
He's 33, she's 40. That's their son, Boston, on the piano. Jackie grew up here. The couple met at Youngstown State University and then promptly left.
That's what you did. You went to school. When you graduated, the first thing you did was you left Youngstown.
After 10 years living in more expensive cities like Tucson and Washington, D.C., they moved back a few years ago with their two children. Both started their own businesses. Jackie's a photographer. Tyler runs a web company. He likens Youngstown to a fixer-upper house.
You're filled with the promise of what it could be rather than the reality of what it is. And I think that's how many of us now are looking at Youngstown, not as a shadow of its former self, but something with incredible potential.
They bought a 5-bedroom house on a historic street for less than $200,000. It's just one opportunity they might never have dreamed of in a thriving city. In Youngstown, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, how untouchables from India are making their mark and some money.
They are master's level social work professionals and master's level clinicians. And they are from the slums, rural and tribal areas of India.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow inched up 1.3%, or 109 points, to finish at 8,029. The Nasdaq eked out a tiny gain of just 1 point to end at 1,626. The S&P 500 added 1.25%, or 10 points, to finish the day at 852. It was that old bad news, good news thing again. Consumer prices fell in March, but the Federal Reserve said parts of the economy appear to be stabilizing. American Express touched off a rally in financial stocks. The credit card giant shares charged up nearly 12% on news that growth in bad loans is slowing. Tech stocks were mixed. Intel weighed on the Nasdaq, chipping off nearly 2.5% on forecasts for a lousy second quarter. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Ever wonder what it takes to make an asset toxic? Check out the Marketplace whiteboard on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for March. President Obama travels to Mexico City before heading to Trinidad and Tobago for the Summit of the Americas. And coffee gets the limelight. Excellent espresso is steamed up during the 10th annual World Barista Championship getting underway in Atlanta. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. We began today talking about those much-anticipated stress test results from the nation's banks. That testing was one of the strings attached to the government's troubled asset relief program. But lately, some financial giants have been questioning whether it's worth getting tangled up in those strings. Goldman Sachs has raised billions of dollars this week aiming to repay TARP funds. It would need government approval to give the money back, and it's not clear if or when that might come. Is the government's banking policy working? Well, as commentator David Frum sees it, that depends on which one you're talking about.
President Barack Obama has two bank policies. One policy is motivated by economic necessity. The other is motivated by political calculation. The two policies contradict each other. You'll never guess which one is prevailing. Policy one, the policy of necessity, is aimed at getting banks lending again. To do that, the Obama administration has put federal money into banks' hands to rebuild their capital bases. The amount a bank can safely lend is a function of the bank's capital. Policy two, the policy of calculation, imposes all kinds of populist limits on the decision-making of subsidized banks. They have been told how much they may pay or bonus their executives. This is reasonable enough in the case of true zombie banks like Citigroup. But the same rules are being applied to institutions like Goldman Sachs and Northern Trust, the largest bank in Illinois, that could have stabilized themselves without direct aid. Northern Trust was pressured into canceling an annual golf tournament the government regarded as too lavish. Northern's mistake, inviting the band Earth, Wind, and Fire to perform. Shortly afterward, the band found a venue at which it was welcome. It performed at the White House for President Obama. Chafing under Policy 2, the policy of calculation, some of those financial institutions, Goldman Sachs most notably, are talking about repaying their TARP funds. The Obama administration is resisting. The administration fears that premature repayment of federal money would shrink the bank's capital bases and reduce their ability to lend, threatening the recovery. So the government is sending a double message to banks. We want you to keep government funds, whether you need them or not, and we want to use those government funds as a justification for dictating to you, whether you asked for them or not. Agreed, some institutions have provoked populist outrage by their own irresponsible behavior. A little moral restraint would be welcome. But political restraint is not. The message that should be sent back to government is back off.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Your thoughts are always welcome at marketplace.org. India's month-long national election begins tomorrow, and all eyes will be on a politician named Mayawati. She's making moves to become the country's next prime minister, which is a big deal, because she's a Dalit. That's what people in the lowest Hindu social castes call themselves. They used to be called untouchables. Mayawati's rise is a hopeful sign for the Dalits. But as Marketplace's Rico Galliano reports, most people of that social level still find themselves struggling for economic equality.
Hello, this is Amol Kamble from India.
Racially, Amol Kamble is no different than any Indian. But socially, his Hindu surname pegs him as a Dalit. I first meet him in Mumbai one night, in a jail. Well, it was a jail back in colonial days. Now it's one of many crowded apartment buildings in this chawl, a neighborhood just a cut above a slum. Amol's whole family, six people, live in one 18-by-20-foot room. They share one bathroom with everyone else on their floor. A few years ago, when Amol attended public college, he found the building just too loud for studying, so he went to a better place.
Are we all going to drive?
We head there by taxi.
Okay.
So where are we going now?
Study Street, which you call Study Street.
Where study Street?
Study Street, yeah.
So everybody in this neighborhood would go to study in this
place? Yeah. Under the street light.
Under the street light?
Yeah.
Amol points out the window, and there they are. Dozens of people on the sidewalk reading textbooks under streetlights. Some have built little campfires. This Dalit student says he wishes the local government would install some seats and leave the streetlights on later so he could study longer. Still, many of these people consider themselves lucky. In some rural areas, Dalit people are considered impure. So low on the social ladder, they're not even supposed to touch the Indian flag. Here in progressive Mumbai, if they get a degree, they could get a decent job. But some say a degree alone won't get Amol out of this chawl. Because even in cities, the remains of the caste system linger.
I feel it is more a psychological problem than social.
Chandraban Prasad is a columnist for India's newspaper, The Pioneer. He's also a Dalit. He says legally, caste discrimination is banned, but that many in the upper castes still can't bring themselves to give Dalit workers promotions, or sometimes hire them at all. He tells me about a 2007 study from a Dalit group and Princeton sociologists. They sent identical fake resumes under different fake surnames to Indian companies.
And often, the resume with the same qualification, with a Dalit-sounding surname, it was rejected.
In some industries, like tech, that's changing. But the one employer Dalits know won't balk at their resumes is the government. For decades, it's had an affirmative action program. Some state and federal jobs get set aside for lower castes. They call this reservation. Emil Cambley's dad worked a reservation job. That's how he could afford to send Emil to school. Prasad says the program has helped.
Federal or state jobs have created a Dalit middle class, but there is not enough.
It's not enough because thanks to privatization, the government is shrinking, and with it, the number of reservation jobs. Prasad says what's needed now is reservation at private companies. The government says it sympathizes, that there's a committee considering the idea, and that they're funding training programs to help Dalits crack the private sector. Sanjay Kumar is with the Ministry of Justice and Empowerment.
Infosys, in partnership with the government, trained 86 students, and I'm glad to tell you that 74 of them have found as good jobs as anyone else in very reputed software companies.
Since this interview, around 500 more graduated that program, but there are an estimated $160 million in India. Meanwhile, a federal bill mandating private reservations is hung up in Parliament. So one Dalit has started his own affirmative action plan.
Hi, this is Michael Thivar. We are at the Philadelphia International Airport. We are waiting for some Dalit friends of ours coming from India.
Michael Thivar is a Dalit himself. After years of work and with the help of a non-Dalit Christian surname, his father converted, he came to the U.S. on an exchange program for social workers. Now he owns two healthcare staffing companies here. And every year since 2001, he's flown in Dalits from India and given them full-time jobs.
They are master's-level social work professionals and master's-level clinicians. And they are from the slums, rural, and tribal areas of India.
Thivar says this is the only program of its kind. Most Indians in America are from middle or upper castes. Dalits are rarely able to migrate here.
Jaibim, sir. Jaibim, welcome, welcome.
Thank you, sir.
So when the new workers arrive, they're dazed at their luck. This is the first time social worker Neetu Bole has ever flown in a plane.
It was, I can say it was amazing. It was like my own dream, which is coming true. Even I was not able to believe that, yeah, it's everything is happening.
Amol Kamble from Study Street was supposed to be one of Neetu's co-workers. Thivar recruited him more than a year ago. But there's a lottery for America's 85,000 skilled worker visas, and Amol lost. He's still back in the chawl. I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, let's call it the quote of the day. It sounds a lot like we're from the government and we're here to help, but the country's top tax man is promising to be sensitive to what he calls the economic realities facing taxpayers this year. As he puts it, we're available to work with people. That's something a lot of anxious Americans might want to keep in mind as we wrestle with tonight's filing deadline. Perhaps even more important, though, are the words of Richard Boggs, who heads an L.A.-based firm that helps delinquent taxpayers called Nationwide Tax Relief. He says he's seeing a huge rise in what he calls the rookie delinquent taxpayer. And he offers this friendly word to the wise: a very innocent procrastination can get you into a lot of hot water with the IRS. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 1.3% over 109 points. The Nasdaq made a tiny gain of just 1 point. The S&P 500 gained 1.25% or 10 points. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gerwitz, Eric Johnson, and Jeff Peters engineer the program for us. Next time, Puerto Vallarta, Cancun, Mazatlan. As travel season kicks off, many are wondering if it's safe to go to Mexico.
99% of the people that go down there basically are in a tourist bubble. They're really not going to be in contact in any way, shape, or form with warring drug gangs.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.